a consensus decision, but maybe my proposal is that we wait 2 more minutes till 5 after and then go ahead and do the meeting. Alternatively, we could reconvene sometime in the next week or two. And when Brad's here, what do you guys think?
I'd say
no
give
need
it a
to
few
raise
minutes.
Hands, just say something.
Give it a few minutes, for sure.
Yeah. I'm back on, by the way. That's okay with me.
Wait. Which one, Bob?
Well, it's okay to wait. I'm sorry. Okay to wait 2 minutes and then, you know, maybe just charge forward, I think. And Madam Vice Chair, I think maybe you should chair the meeting if you're up with it, up for it.
Yeah, I'm fine to sort of moderate a little bit. So thank you for that. Is there anybody that disagrees with that? So that we're going to push on ahead? All right, well, did I hear someone?
I think you can go ahead. I think it's good.
All right, so in the absence of the chair of the Habitat Committee, this is Commissioner Barbara Baker calling the Habitat Committee to order. I understand there's 2 items on the agenda. I think that I'll just turn it over to Margan and let you take it away. Again, we had a committee meeting this morning where, since these are committees, we basically made them discussions. So if any commissioners or staff have anything that they need to say, simply raise your hand or basically butt in and we will recognize you. It's just, that just seems the best way to handle things. So Margan.
Thank you, Commissioner Baker. And I think that format is wonderful. It works really well today. We've got, and the we, I think, is me. You'll notice Jeff is here as well as Director Suswind, and there's quite a lot of action going on Habitat items. And so per, I think, our last couple, we wanted to use this committee time to help give you all information. There are a number of topics that might lead to decisions by the commission or sort of provide policy context for us as an agency. And each of these important topics is a place where we can start to lay out more of the operating environment for you. That's our intent today. So 3 topics, organize these just around the habitats themselves. We can do it another way, but I think this is a nice way to think about what is your habitat program engaged in and how does it relate to some of the other habitat types that maybe you're more familiar with as supporting species, either some of the salmon and steelhead, the important fisheries, or for some of the species like sage grouse that we have particular species management objectives around. And again, I would just invite Jeff and Director Suswind to hop in whenever possible. So we're starting off here with riparian habitat. And this is something we spent a little more time digging into at our last meeting. We've got under the R values there, the way that we are framing as an agency, what we are looking for from habitat, from riparian habitat. This one is important because you may recall from our last conversation that as we face the increased drivers across the state of both population growth and development, as well as ongoing climate change, one of the things that's becoming increasingly true is that not only are riparian habitats really important now for both what they provide to salmon and steelhead and the in-stream resources, but also because of the incredibly high proportion of terrestrial species that really depend on riparian ecosystems for some portion of their life. And in particular, as we see the increasing effects of climate change, you know, the network of riparian ecosystems across the state is going to become a really important system of nodes and corridors for those species both to have access to and to move to where the conditions are going to be as best as possible for them. You might recall, so I think two big focus areas for this update. One, as you see there, we're getting close to finalizing the priority habitats and species riparian management guidelines, volume 2. As you may recall, volume 1 was the peer-reviewed synthesis of the science around riparian ecosystems and how fish and wildlife, with a special focus on fish, depend on the functions of riparian ecosystems. Volume 2 is the place where we are translating that summary of riparian science as it relates to fish, and saying, so what, therefore, what do we recommend people do about it in order to achieve or march towards this value that we have at the top of the page of really protecting and even enhancing riparian ecosystems statewide. We had, thinking about what steps to call your attention to here, you may recall that we had done about a year ago a really large round of public review and comment and tribal review and comment. And as a result of that, really overhauled the document in many ways to have it be zeroed in like a laser on fish and wildlife resources. We, right before our last conversation, I believe, we had just completed a round of tribal consultation on the revised draft. And as a result of that, really got positive feedback from our tribal co-managers about this document and the way that it provided a really a clear and compelling statement about how riparian ecosystems are incredibly important, in particular to salmon. And I think the one pivotal piece that came out of the science document and we have reiterated more strongly in volume 2 is that riparian ecosystems out to a distance of site potential tree height, which is the height a tree can grow at 200 years. And if that tree were to fall over from the stream that distance, most of those functions, or we have the greatest confidence that most of those functions that fish and wildlife depend on will be provided in that space. And that has really become a rallying cry and a focus point and a goal for the broader policy conversations involving the governor's office and other state agencies. We had been thinking about context and sequencing given the policy environment that you see there in the second bullet. The governor has convened tribal governments and the state agencies to try to figure out how can we achieve healthy riparian ecosystems throughout the state, and are there different things that the executive branch needs to do to support that goal? Starting to feel like I'm rambling, so I'm gonna pause for just a minute. I was imagining most of our conversation time would be about the second bullet and sketching out and answering your questions about that policy operating environment around a riparian ecosystem management. But I do wanna pause and ask, do you have any questions in particular about the step of finalizing our PHS Volume 2 document before we open it up?
Dumb question, but what's PHS stand for?
Well, there are no dumb questions. That's Priority Habitats and Species. So that's the program that's the program that the Habitat Program manages, and it's the mechanism by which we take the species and ecological science in part from fish program, wildlife program, from our habitat science, and we serve it up to people outside the agency. So we've got a list of priority habitats and species and associated data that we collect and others collect. And that really informs in particular like local land use regulations and management choices. And we also have a series of guidance documents and staff technical assistance that helps people figure out like, okay, if I've got a priority habitat or species, as part of my responsibility area, what do I do about that?
Okay, good. Thank you.
Of course.
So, Morgan, this is Barbara. Sort of a similarly odd question. The second bullet, policy environment. That is unusual language. I've heard that there's a lot going on between agencies and the governor's office on this, but it's all been very vague and very general. Are there going to be like bills or funding requests or policy objectives that are developed out of that policy environment? And if so, will they be then returned to us in case we need to do something about one or any of them?
Great question. So I think it's highly likely that out of this governor's office-led process, which includes all the state agencies that have a connection to riparian, as well as tribal governments across the state, that there could be, and there likely would be, policy bills where there's an observation by the group that a policy change needs to be made in order to better achieve our riparian goals, whether that's something to do with Growth Management Act or Shoreline Management Act, whether that's something to do with water quality, something to do with the state's restoration programs and approach. And of course, as you say, there could also be funding requests. I think to the degree that any of those policy changes or funding requests are connected to Department of Fish and Wildlife's work, I'm looking to Jeff or Director Suzman to say if they feel differently, but I think those should come back to the commission at least to discuss. You know, we're past the agency request legislation, or we're getting farther into the agency request legislation and budget packages. So it's possible, we haven't discussed the mechanisms for bills or for funding requests, but it's possible that those would be governor requests, legislation or bills. And in that case, again, it probably wouldn't be for decision by the commission, but I think having conversations here so the commission is able to continue tracking those big changes would be important.
Okay, thank you.
And Kelly or Jeff, is there anything that you guys would want to add based on your vantage point about the relationship between the governor's process and things we might want to be prepared for or thinking about here?
Well, I think you did a really nice job, Morgan, laying it out. And that effort's got a lot of steam behind it, but we haven't made a ton of progress yet on just exactly where the group lands. And I think you're right, it'll likely be governor request legislation, particularly its effort with tribes, et cetera. The governor's going to want to have that be owned by him, I'm sure. As we get further down there, towards the finish of that, we'll make sure we keep this group informed. We're taking a pretty aggressive stand in that forum that, you know, status quo is not working. We need to make some improvements. That's going to ruffle feathers inside the group and outside. So definitely there'll be plenty to talk about, but I think you've laid out the hierarchy and the process as well.
So I have a question then for the director. So do you think it would be useful then to support the department's efforts if we were to develop some sort of policy week, meaning the commission, to support you or just curious what your thoughts are on that.
And I'd like Jeff to weigh in too. My reaction would be potentially, but not at this point in time, partly because I couldn't direct you to what really would support us or where until I know more about the actual path of that group. It's uncertain enough that we could develop a policy that's completely inconsistent and would have to revisit it or tell the governor we don't agree with them. So I'd like them to make more progress before we find our landing place.
So then so department staff is engaged in just tracking this and participating and offering yourself up as resource and that's kind of ongoing. And when there is a time, if and when there is a time, you'll let the commission know then about policy development, perhaps?
Yeah, definitely. I want to make sure that we're, I feel like we're pushing the envelope, but we're within the sideboards where we are as an agency and the commission and the strategic plan, et cetera. It's nothing we haven't said before, but it's stuff that people don't necessarily like hearing. And I see Jeff, who's, it's central to those operations. I it's an awkward silence from you, Jeff.
That's maybe because I'm awkward. Yeah, I don't, at this time, a policy probably is premature. I would, though, recall Vice Chair Baker's desire to have a conversation at some point about a conservation policy. So rather than having habitat by habitat by habitat, it would be good as we suss out what is possible, what the commitments might be coming out of this co-manager, governor's office, riparian work group, to fold that into a broader policy that would be super helpful to the department as we move forward.
Yeah, I see Commissioner Anderson's hand is up. Are you out there, Jim?
I am out here.
Okay.
Go ahead. I've got the getting to the issue of doing something and understand where the department is and where Kelly is at, because it's perhaps not entirely ripe to push specifics, but clearly the leadership and direction for something here will be greatly improved with the strong department commitment and Fish and Wildlife Commission's support as we go forward. One of the big criticisms in the past has been the department, you know, just focuses on, you know, harvest or hatcheries with regard to salmon and steelhead in particular, but doesn't get out enough in the habitat. And this obviously is moving in the right direction and in a good way that we ought to be fully supporting. I know the tribes feel that the department, understandably, they understand that the department doesn't have as much authority in some of these areas that they would prefer, but they really do believe that the commission and the department should have the high ground and move these things forward. So there'll be a lot of resistance, or lack of better term, inertia by other agencies that do have some place to play, whether it's agriculture or economic development or even ecology, that we ought to be pushing as this goes forward.
Were you listening in on the calls?
No.
you really nailed it.
Absolutely. Well, and it might be good. So the last item we have on this agenda is to talk about the co-manager habitat work plan. And I think it might be nice to pick back up this exact line of conversation in the context of that co-manager habitat work plan, because I think my observation is that given everything that Commissioner Anderson summarized, we are, as an agency, and as Kelly said, we're sort of finding our voice to be more clear and less equivocal about what the effects of different policy choices are on fish and wildlife. And I think that's part of the tension that Commissioner Anderson is describing. But it's making the conversation rich and more real, I think, about whether we're achieving the goals that we have for fish and wildlife and habitats. And if not, you know, what do we do about that? And I think there is an important intersection with our conversations with tribal co-managers. Commissioner Baker, is it okay to move on to the next item in the agenda?
It is absolutely fine. Go ahead, Morgan.
All right. So another topic that I really enjoyed our conversation around was the discussion about the increasing project developments that we're facing in Washington State. And I've intersected them here under the title of shrub step habitat because as you likely know from past presentations or your own general knowledge or tracking important species like sage grouse, shrub step habitat.
Morgan, I need to interrupt you just for a second. I just got a note from Nikki that our chair has joined us. So we're going to welcome Brad and turn over this meeting to him.
No, I'm sorry. I had to take a rental car back and I got stuck in traffic. There was an accident. So that's why I'm here. I've been here for
welcome
a few
back,
minutes.
Commissioner. So.
Thank you.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you. So, pleasure to see most of you.
Play just guessing which is which, right?
That's pin the tail on the appropriate donkeys now.
Nice to see you, Commissioner Smith. Would you like to make any other opening remarks before we...
No, I just listened to the previous conversation and and the politics of it, I understand. And I, you know, what Kelly said, the governor's going to want to have ownership on this. So, but no, I think we're on track. And again, Jeff, you were outstanding earlier this morning and you're following suit again. So.
Well, I'm glad my partner in crime is here today. Well, thinking again about shrub step, so as you guys know from our past conversations, both populate, I mean, again, it's very similar story in some ways to riparian in that climate change and the effects of climate change are something we're increasingly tracking and digging into across habitat types, certainly for shrub step, as well as solar power development, solar power project development. We talked the last committee meeting and commission meeting, I believe, about that there are approximately, I believe it's 40 square miles of solar projects proposed in Washington State, many of which overlap with shrub step habitat. And then, of course, there are the associated effects of our growth and our development and our human use on the landscape, like fire and fire management, as Commissioner Linville knows all too well, and that's a big deal for shrub step. And so one of the things I wanted to give you a little bit of context for and see if you have questions or, feedback for us at this stage is give you a sense of, given all of that and the incredible action around shrub step protection, what are we doing as an agency to try to be prepared and engage effectively in that environment? So the first key question is, well, what guidance are we providing to staff right now? How are we organizing our thinking and what we know right now? The first document we're trying to create is a set of guidance to staff, sort of current guidance, pulling together what we know about shrub step habitat and in particular solar power. And we're creating essentially a solar power considerations for habitat, which is then a guidance document and a set of sort of key thinking questions that each of our field biologists who are engaged in the review and the comment of all these solar projects, it can guide their thinking and help them offer the best sort of feedback, concerns, and solutions to each of these solar projects as that are in the hopper already right now. We also know that there are a couple of science gaps. So that second, third bullet there, does the science indicate burned areas still have habitat value? This is a key question that's come up both in our engagement with local jurisdictions as they consider approve more regular development proposals, as well as with solar power. It turns out that the science is very clear and unequivocal, and it has been for decades, that fire is a natural part of the regime in shrub step ecosystems, and that while the habitat functions and values may be sort of temporarily affected when a fire moves through, because it's a normal part of that ecosystem, those habitats still do have value and they will increasingly have functions and values to provide to the species that live there as it, as the habitat recovers from fire. We had in our existing priority habitats and species, or PHS shrub step guidance document, not explicitly talked about the role of fire in shrub step. And so as a result, we were having some discussions with local governments where there are some, hey, you're silent about the habitat values of burned areas, therefore they must not have value and we can go ahead and approve this development with no mitigation or compensation for the burned portions of that area. And so I just reviewed within the last couple of weeks an addendum that our wildlife program experts and our habitat program experts worked on to update that guidance document to be clear about what the science says about the value of burned areas. And then in a related way, we were getting some questions from some of these solar project proponents questioning what science exists that helps us understand what the potential effects of solar power are on habitats. And I think especially for lay people who don't study these topics, I think there's an assumption that if there isn't a study that looks exactly at solar power development and measures its effects, that there's nothing we can say that has a science basis. When in fact, you know, we have quite a bit of peer-reviewed published literature that talks about how shrub step habitats might react to changes in shade or soil moisture or microclimate. And so from that kind of literature, we're able to infer to the degree a project, including a solar power project, changes shade or sun or moisture in that area, what its effects will be on that habitat. So we're pulling together that science in a lines of evidence paper that will summarize some of those trains of thought that help us link what already exists in the science to making smart assessments about an analysis about what the effects of project solar power projects will be. And I think by making that more clear and transparent, it's gonna help our own staff. And it's also gonna help some of the partners that we work with, including the solar power project proponents, see what we see in the literature. And again, we're hoping that makes for more clear and richer conversations about trade-offs in these projects, the potential compensation maybe as those projects move forward.
Yeah, Morgan, can I ask a question? And yes. Also to Jeff, what we started to work on last month on coming from the governor's conversation about how we're interacting in the broad area on climate issues, you know, where we're going with all of that. And I need to get a follow-up on all of that, but that's at a later date. I'm assuming that what you're addressing here will be incorporated into whatever bullet points or short white paper that we will be presenting to the governor, right?
Jeff, can you help me with that one?
Yeah, well, I'll see. So likely. So tomorrow, I think, we're on the agenda to give the climate change briefing to the full commission.
Right.
We're going to talk about some of our work in climate change, but we're also going to focus on what the governor specifically asked, which is tell me what efforts you're going to make to go, and not, these aren't the exact words he used, but essentially, how are you going to get hunters and anglers to get involved in climate change and climate resiliency moving forward so that their interests are protected into the future. So if hearing me say that and then tying it back to the shrub step component, there's recovery efforts, right? So it's not a stretch for the conservation organizations that we already work with. They're already very prominently thinking about climate change and renewable energies and effects on on fish and wildlife species in shrub step habitats. It will be an effort to talk to, in this particular case, hunters about the role of shrub step and how renewable energy, and if I'm focused on solar, may affect their opportunities and the wildlife populations that they're interested in that we manage. So there are some direct connections here for sure.
Okay, well, thanks. You know, I was just looking at the last line there, you know, how are we coordinating with others? It just seemed that to be a segue and all that. But I do see that Commissioner Linville's got her hand up too.
Yeah, so I hope I can get through. Hope I can get through this. In the last 5 days, we've lost 500,000 acres of shrub step habitat. This is essentially all of our sage grouse habitat and sharp tailed grouse habitat. I hate to be the one that tells you this, but right now, solar energy is sort of the least of our problems out here. And recovery is gonna need to be a focus.
I'm sorry. No, we're all with you on that.
It's just, you have to understand that our shrub step habitat is essentially gone. And so it's very hard to listen about renewable energy and climate change right now. And so I just hope that maybe, we can sort of double down and refocus our efforts on recovery. And I just think that we don't have any sort of where else to go from here. And I'm really sorry, but I'm sure it feels like a lot of folks are just really removed from this, but literally our best shrub step habitat in this state is gone, temporarily gone. It does recover. I just want to make you all aware of that, because we're talking about it like it's still here and it's just not.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Yeah, Jeff.
Thank you, Commissioner Linville. While we may not be standing right with the fires, we share the importance of that. I mean, prior to the fires, we were down to about 40% of historical shrub step. And not all shrub step is equal, especially when it comes to sage grouse and sharp tail. And I couldn't agree more with the opportunity here's what I do know. If we don't get out post-fire and actually double down, like you're saying, on restoration, then, cheatgrass is a pretty phenomenal species. It comes in and it compromises the quality of the shrub step that you're trying to restore. So I'm with you, Morgan. I'm confident is with you, and this can be part of our strategy moving forward. For us, we share the importance of it because for some reason, in our experience as habitat people, folks oftentimes view it as rattlesnake habitat or untamed land that needs to be tamed. So we've been fighting the, God darn it, don't you people realize how important this is? Sure, you can look out and see a landscape and go, what's the problem? But when you're down to 40% and now even way less than that, we got a crisis on our hands. So I would love to talk more with you about that. I know this is important to Director Suswin as well. Let's make sure that we double down on that restoration, because that can also work to get other people more knowledgeable about that importance, and quite frankly, more involved in owning the importance of shrub step as we move forward. I also appreciate comments about it's gone, so cool, you could talk about solar all you want, I also don't want us to lose. Right now, we already have 40 square miles. Now, maybe it's burned, but what we don't want is 40 square miles of solar proposals. That's private sector only. That will go in and absolutely prevent the opportunity to even do the restoration efforts. And then there's 2 square miles alone just with DNR's 500 megawatt solar goal on trust lands. So I think that we got to double down on the restoration for sure, and it needs to happen as soon as possible. And we need to be mindful. We are playing in the renewable energy. I've had multiple conversations with legislators because what I see is a lot of flat roofs. The easy pathway is to put solar out in habitat. So we use the term no regrets renewables. And in fact, I have an upcoming conversation with Matt Stewart-Walt. He used to work in the governor's office, but now represents a solar company in some of that. So we're working to make sure that we avoid and minimize the need to put renewables out in these habitats. And again, maybe Margan, you and I can follow up with Commissioner Linville and start building some strategies on how we can get restoration efforts going ASAP.
Absolutely. And Commissioner Linville, thank you for your remarks and helping to emphasize why these areas are so important. And I am really happy with the timing of that update about the importance even of burned areas, because I think that adds power to our effort, as you say, that now needs to be focused on recovery of these areas and making some investments so that we're maximizing and helping that recovery happen as quickly as it can. I also don't want to see a push of development had we not tried to make these points really clear, thinking that, oh, hey, now's the perfect time and our opportunity to get that recovery to happen. I welcome that conversation and follow-up as well. We can share a little bit more about maybe how we can use some of the sense of urgency that we're all feeling as a result of these fires to help some of our partners who might not be thinking about what no regret solar means really understand that and feel that same sense of urgency that we do. I think there had been, in some places up until this point, maybe a little bit of a sense that, well, hey, solar, we should just all be glad that it's going in everywhere and not really understanding what we have seen as I like that, Jeff, the no regrets solar.
Yeah, I think Molly, I know we're all on the same page, and your heartfelt words resonate well with all of us. So thank you. Yes, Barbara. You're muted, Barbara.
I also want to add my note to Molly. There, you apologized about 6 times during your talk, Molly, and there's so no need for apologies on an issue as serious as this, and both the stress of the ongoing fire danger, the fact that we don't have any rain in the forecast, and not that there's any real comparison, but we had a big fire here yesterday on Mima Mounds, which is a really incredible little habitat in an urban area, essentially, and I know 2 people that one lost a house and one lost a barn. It's a small fire in comparison, but the point is that none of us should feel removed from the fire issue, because it's coming to us as well. That's my comment. If there's anything that we can do to help you, Molly, over there dealing with what you're dealing with, please let us know. I realize that's a kind of an empty gesture, but I would love to be any assistance I can. My question is, when private solar or even maybe private windmills, when alternative energy goes in on these areas of land that some people consider worth less than other areas, is there a mitigation factor for either recovery or for trying to figure out a way to make them ecologically sound, maybe even beneficial in a habitat way, as well as providing power? Or is that not something that happens?
Well, the short answer is that's not really something that happens today. The project proponent has the option of choosing a permitting pathway through the local government, which is often the county, or choosing the energy facility siting, FSEC, energy facility, Joe Panesco could probably help me. I forget what the acronym stands for, but it's essentially sort of you want to correct me, Joe?
I'll have to look it up. I don't have an energy facility. Yeah, I'll look it up.
Siting and evaluation committee.
Siting.
Yeah. So it's a state commission that can provide a statewide look at permitting for energy projects, including solar. Most of the solar projects that we're seeing right now have chosen the local government permitting pathway. And, that probably should not be a surprise. The strength of the protections and therefore the avoidance minimization or compensation measures that are required of a project in that local government pathway depend entirely on how that local government's code is written to protect areas. Without going into much detail, most of the local government ordinances rely on there being sort of a documented presence of a particular listed species or a particular critical habitat type to even trigger any protections. And I'm not aware of any of them that require enhancement of the current condition. And we could probably have a whole separate line of conversation that could reflect what Jeff and I are learning about why that is the case. No net loss essentially doesn't have any risks of triggering the takings of private property, as the idea of requiring a permit applicant to improve the existing quality of the habitat. And Jeff, I don't know if you want to add anything there.
Yeah, that is one of the things that we're trying to support in our conversations with legislators, shifting all of these for consistency's sake over to FSEC and taking away the government pathway. And that's important for a couple reasons. One, we sit on FSEC. and two, FSEC, there's a firewall between our rep on FSEC and our technical assistance. So the FSEC has a contract with us to provide technical review of proposals and recommend mitigation measures. So it gives us a way stronger seat at the table and in the conversation about if those projects are gonna go in there, what the appropriate mitigation needs to be. Tangentially or connected to, but parallel, is the agency's effort. And I don't know, I saw net ecological gain on the agenda. That is something that we continue to pursue with legislators and local governments and state agencies and tribes. And we're likely to see litigation. We're likely to see legislation again this session trying to push that concept at a watershed scale. So if that goes statewide, we would have a vehicle to maybe get no net loss at the site, but to overall improve the environmental baseline at the watershed scale.
And if I can jump in, FSEC is the Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council.
Thank you, Joe. Commissioner Smith, do we have any other questions or comments on?
I don't see any hands raised. Any of my colleagues have anything else to ask? No. And Morgan, are you finished up?
Yeah, we'll come back again at the end of the conversation, not so much to touch on shrubs, step habitat, but to, as I mentioned, we'll talk about our last agenda item is our habitat co-manager work plan, which I think will tie together some of these things that we're talking about and shift towards how are we trying to come to some common objectives and share effort with our tribal co-managers, which is a little bit of shifting to the how are we taking action on these things. Before we get there, though, our second to the last agenda item is giving you guys a little bit of a glimpse into how we're engaged as an agency and leading the way in another important habitat type, which is our nearshore habitats in Puget Sound. So I want to get in a better habit with this committee of shining a spotlight on some of the relatively sort of mature and longstanding programs that we have in the agency to bring resources, attention, and action to different habitat types. And one of these is our Estuary and Salmon Restoration Program, or ESRP. This is a restoration grant funding program. It's been funded by the legislature for about the last 10 years. It was initially began as an early action program to reflect the science that came out of the Puget Sound Nearshore Ecosystem Restoration Project, or PISNRP, horrible acronym. But that effort was to look at the science of Puget Sound recovery, in particular for these shoreline or near shore environments that are so essential to forage fish, to salmon, and to the food web in Puget Sound, and aimed at a partnership with the Army Corps of Engineers to try to bring Army Corps of Engineers style planning, horsepower, money, and restoration effort to Puget Sound. That PISNRP, or Puget Sound Nearshore effort with the Corps, is ongoing, but this Estuary and Salmon Restoration Program was an acknowledgement by the state legislature that there's really compelling science out there about nearshore restoration and how to do it well, and the state wanted to get a head start of putting some money specifically to those nearshore restoration projects. You can see in the little map inset, that's a snapshot of the locations of projects that have been funded by this Estuary and Salmon Restoration program since 2006. The reason I want to highlight it here, so we run this program jointly with the Recreation and Conservation Office. RCO manages the money and the contracts associated with these projects, but Department of Fish and Wildlife staff provide sort of the brains behind the strategy of this program, running the grant solicitation, and then doing the evaluation of the project submittals that we get and which are the highest quality. Every biennium, we partner with the Recreation and Conservation Office to run that grant program and then serve up a biennial project list to the legislature. And what we found, I think, is that by doing that and doing that grant funding up front, we come up with an amazing list of projects that really have benefit to the Puget Sound, to forage fish, to salmon. And it's helped this program, I think, be relatively successful. As I said, it's been funded consistently, I guess it's more than 10 years now, since 2006. So this biennium, I'm highlighting for you the milestone that program has just finished running their grant solicitation, doing the valuation, and as a result, they finalized this biennium's list that's been submitted to the governor's office by RCO. The list has about $20 million worth of projects, and a rough breakdown is that 70 to 80% of those are actual on-the-ground restoration or acquisition and protection projects. That program sets aside a small amount of money, $500,000 in this case, for small grants. So that's to make sure that as our restoration efforts in Puget Sound have become more and more complex and taking on the bigger projects, that we don't still lose the opportunity of giving small grants to what might be more like small community or mom and pop type projects, not high dollar amount, but have incredible value, including sort of the outreach, education, and community engagement value in Puget Sound Recovery. This program is also notable because they have since early on set aside money for what they call learning projects, which is making sure that we are gathering data, asking key questions about how to make restoration more effective over time. And so in this particular grant list, there's about 10% of the funding that they're recommending go to some of these learning projects. And then the last bullet there, this program also took on something called Shore Friendly. So this grew out of a research project that WDFW funded to help of all shoreline owners, landowners in Puget Sound, what are the things that might help incentivize or compel them to not put in bulkheads or take bulkheads out and have more natural shorelines that have habitat value? And what are some of the barriers that we can take away? This shore-friendly program capitalizes on what we learned in that research project, which is that if we provide funding, expertise, and materials to local permit counters, and we're presenting shoreline landowners right up front with some of the science about the habitat value and some recommendations about what they can do on their property that would help them be better stewards, was really effective, and that particular set of landowners was really receptive to that. So this project list includes a recommendation of $2 million to be passed through to those local permit counter technical assistance programs. So again, all in all, I just wanted to highlight for you guys a program that's been longstanding. It's been really successful. And the other thing we feel really proud about, and I wanted you guys to know about it, it's a really holistic program. As you can see from those components that I just went through, they're really trying to integrate everything from the actual on-the-ground effort to learning to make sure that we're adjusting where we need to and we're actually getting the results that we want, as well as making sure that we're engaged with local communities, both through small grants and through this technical assistance, again, so that at the end of the day, we're marching steadily towards restored habitat and helping people take care of the nearshore habitat that we do have right now. If any of you are interested, I can send out a link to the webpage we've got for that program. But again, really successful program, and I'm happy to answer any questions or hear any comments you guys have about that.
I see no hands up. Any questions? I'd like to see that link, Morgan, if you could send it. Yeah. I'd like to see what kind of programs are, you know, some visuals. Okay, I think we're ready to move on then.
All right. Well, the last topic, as I mentioned and you saw at the beginning, is Jeff and I and Dr. Suzuwin wanted to give you an overview about an increased partnership and an ongoing effort as we engage with our tribal co-managers. We're calling it the Co-Manager Habitat Work Plan. The origins of this effort were Jeff and I and Fran Wills-Husen, who's the Senior Habitat Policy Advisor for Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, increasingly recognizing that tribal governments and Department of Fish and Wildlife similar goals and values in many ways around what we're trying to achieve about habitat and how we want to bring attention and increased results. I think in part driven by the shared sense of urgency that so many of us have around the ongoing state of our salmon and steelhead populations. And so the question, it really began as a conversation about like, man, we really could get so much farther if we were operating closer together and had a plan that articulated what some of these shared goals are around key habitat protection and enhancement elements. The bullets that you see on the screen are the habitat protection and enhancement topics typically as pivotal in our shared efforts to protect and restore habitat, in particular for salmon and steelhead. I think one that's been really exciting is that starting during last year, this last North of Falcon negotiation, habitat, as you I think have probably heard from Jeff or Kelly, habitat has been increasingly recognized in our fishery management conversations as essential to achieving the harvest goals that we want and getting us out of a situation where there are so many constraints on our fisheries. No surprise, I suppose, but it's been really exciting to see that growing realization that we need to knock down kind of the silo walls between how we're managing habitat and trying to engage and how we're managing our fisheries. Maybe I'll pause there and see Jeff or Kelly, if there's anything you want to add big picture here. I think our goal is just to start to build awareness with the Habitat Committee, and maybe through the conversation and the questions, figure out what additional conversation we can set up to help the commission see what's going on here and be engaged in a helpful way. And maybe while Jeff and Kelly are thinking a little bit, I wanted to make a link to some of our earlier conversations. We mentioned that we've been trying to be, as an agency, more clear and unequivocal about how we see the trade-offs that we're seeing in the current world around habitat protection and enhancement and that sense of urgency. And whether it's in riparian habitat management or thinking about restoration or the particular focus we now have associated with this plan on the Stillaguamish watershed, which is in dire straits for spring Chinook, always a topic of conversation in our fisheries management. I think we've seen that growing sense of urgency by our tribal partners to have us show up and really be allies and appropriately advocating for what we think needs to happen to help us achieve our part of the state mission. And I think that's also a really fruitful conversation for us here today. Jeff or Kelly, have I talked long enough? What would you like to add?
Jeff, you want to go first?
You go.
So I think the key here is just making sure you're all aware of this effort and or efforts. This is one of those remarkable no-brainers that didn't enter anybody's brain for a long, long time, decades. The folks that Morgan and Jeff know in tribal land they've been working with for years are different than the folks that Ron Warren knows working on the fishery side for years. And they don't really talk to each other in tribal land, and that's reflected in our agency as well. Just a remarkable distance between those two groups. And the reality is both groups know and have known all along they need to be coordinated and work together. But this is more of a realization that those have to be coordinated first, I would say, amongst the different organizations being, you know, the agency and or tribes. And then the same level of integration needs to happen between us and the tribes. We're shooting for the same thing. The more we're coordinated, the better we'll be, the more successful we'll be. So it's a number of efforts through the governor's riparian effort we've already talked about, the North of Falcon effort, legislative efforts. We need to increase our coordination with tribes and internally, both within our agency and tribes, the coordination between the fishery side of the management and the habitat side of the management.
So I have a quick question. Has this effort, this co-manager habitat work plan, was that in place prior to, this most recent North of Falcon discussions director, you know, that you mentioned, has this been, you know, has WDFW and Northwest Indian Fish Commission, at least the habitat folks, been talking about this, you know, before this really became front and center in this most recent North of Falcon, or did the North of Falcon discussion help kind of stimulate this co-manager habitat work plan?
Well, I want to be careful. We have talked about the same thing. The co-manager work plan, that when I hear that, I think of the North of Falcon co-manager work plan as separate from the
habitat,
governor's,
the
riparian.
Yeah, the co-manager habitat work plan.
I believe this to be true, that when Jeff attended North of Falcon the year before last, or North of Falcon before last, that was one of, if not the first time that we actually had a habitat presence at North of Falcon. And with that, we agreed with the Fish Commission that we need a habitat plan that was really more fleshed out in this last North of Falcon. We had a plan to plan basically the year before, but this was the first real plan, and it comes directly out of North of Falcon.
Yeah. Yes, I do remember seeing Jeff in the hallways down at Rohnert Park 2 years ago. So,
yeah.
And welcome to the party.
And everybody's saying, you're a habitat guy. What are you doing here?
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize the fact that we do, as part of this work plan, you see all these bullets on the slide. We are engaged with the Stillaguamish tribe on a Stilly pilot, where we're working on all of these, or most of these at this point, try to make a big difference sooner rather than later, given the constraints. And we'll continue to focus on the constricted docks, right? So part of this, a priority is to restore the value of the treaties, but also restore the non-tribal fisheries and the value of those, and the stability economically and socially and politically that would bring to restoring those fisheries. In addition, recovery is always, it's a gate that we need to walk through before we can get back to as close to the good old days as we can get to with natural origin population increases. So I like to view, I think some, we have a tendency to differentiate, like, oh, these are hatchery, and yeah, then there's that habitat stuff. Well, that habitat stuff, quite frankly, from my perspective, is the natural hatchery system. And so part of this plan is to really dive in to these particular areas of habitat and monitor. So you all saw a North of Falcon habitat deck pack as example. That deck pack is the foundational start to putting more of these things in place in more areas and monitoring the fish in, fish out, to see how are we doing when we take these actions. Are we seeing the results? And if not, why? And how can we adaptively manage moving forward? So, I'll stop there.
I see Commissioner Anderson has got his hand up.
Yes, this is it's extremely important. I'm thinking in particular the softer issue, if you will, in terms of outreach and education, but critically important in the need to link this up early and often, I think, with fishermen that are big voices in North of Falcon and presence on websites and the like. It just seems to me that everybody goes into North of Falcon, and as we've talked about, it's the allocation game, and we need to really make sure that we're creatively engineering the communication so that people are making the cause and effect right away and right from the start. And so so it's real when they're having to make decisions regarding, as decisions are made on allocation, that they're recognizing the cause and effect. And so I think it goes without saying in many ways with this group, but I think it's important to emphasize.
Thanks for saying that, Commissioner Anderson. I know that that's been something that we've observed and been working on both with Kelly, with Ron Warren, and also with the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission staff, is noting what you said, that, and I think Director Suzman said it earlier, you know, the fisheries staff, even inside our organization or in tribal governments, are different than the habitat staff. And so there's definitely been a big learning curve, I think, on the fisheries manager side to even know how they or we might be engaged in habitat issues and what's possible and what levers we can try to pull there. And then I think for the habitat focused folks in each organization and each government, there's a learning curve in some cases about how to speak fisheries lingo. And that's a really big machine. How can we help them better engage by kind of translating our habitat talk into ways that we both would understand? It's been pretty clear that each group of folks, the habitat folks and the fisheries folks, really have strong cultures and languages. And so it was surprising to me the degree to which, and maybe it shouldn't have been surprising, but the degree to which we really have to work hard to share information and help each other understand each other's work.
The need to be bilingual. Does that wrap up your presentation, Morgan?
Yeah, this wraps up the slides for sure and the agenda that we have identified. I think maybe I would just say, I thought Director Suzman and Jeff did a better job than I had been doing of saying sort of what's the problem statement, or why should the commission and the habitat committee of the commission care about each of these topics. I would just invite you guys, I think I'm still trying to tune up my ability to make these connections for you guys in a way that feels relevant. It feels relevant to your work. And so please, if you have observations or recommendations about how to make that tighter as we're trying to showcase more of the habitat work for you and support sort of your learning and insights into this, I look forward to your suggestions. I feel some of that same sense of like, how do I translate for you all to help you be the best habitat committee you can be? So please, if you ever have questions about, now, why exactly are we talking about this thing, or, you know, what's the policy or importance of this, please don't hesitate to ask.
Well, you guys do a great job at that. And as Commissioner Anderson said, this is really critically important stuff. And language does play a big part of it. We don't, you know, we talk over each other, around each other, and we don't, but trying to get people to work together in a common direction, common denominators are not very common, you know. So this is having this, you know, how we can, you know, Jeff showing up at North of Falcon and all these, we need to continually work on it. It's common sense, but again, it's not done. So keep our fingers to the fire. So you ask for what we need to tell you. You tell us what we need to do. So.
Well, one additional thought.
Except Jeff.
Well, you may be disappointed at my comment then, because the one piece that occurs to me that I think we should keep in mind for a future conversation of this committee is more strongly making the links between the emerging clarity and potentially policy statements coming out of the strategic plan and the way that Jeff and his team, working with you all, have help to crystallize our statements and our strategies around conservation. I think making those links and making sure that the ways we're talking about and engaged on some of these habitat topics continue to reflect your evolving policy and vision thinking more broadly around the strategic plan. I know that's a little bit of a broad topic, but I think much of what we were here to talk with you about today is going to be how major parts of our strategic plan become action or not. And so I'm very interested for us to have conversations about whether you see shifts in direction or strategy that might be needed based on our evolving thinking around the strategic plan. And certainly that's something Jeff and I will continue to be talking about, but seems yeah. really relevant for this committee as well.
Sounds like a plan. Okay. Does that wrap us up then?
Hey, Commissioner Smith.
Yes.
Could I send a shout out? I missed the first little bit of the meeting and I want to make sure. And Morgan, did you already talk about the award that was received by some habitat staff around climate change work at OFWA?
No, because I didn't know about it.
Oh, okay. Well, let me just give a little plug for some nationally recognized work that that we just got awarded as part of the Climate Leadership Award from OFWA. There was an award given to WFW for our Climate Adapted Culverts Project Team and the Climate Impacts Group at University of Washington. And I'm just going to read you, it's a quick little paragraph, but I think it's pretty inspiring. And it really is a national, it's nationally important. So the project, the Climate Adapted Culverts Project, was initiated by DFW and grew to become a partnership with the Climate Impacts Group. The project's goal is to make projections of future changes in stream flows and channel widths due to climate change available to engineers designing culverts. And that goal has been achieved through an internet site that enables engineers to obtain site-specific information for designing climate-adapted culverts. And this is critical information because Washington is currently investing billions of dollars to repair fish passage barriers that hinder the recovery of imperiled salmon stocks. The team created an internet application so that any engineer could click on any stream road intersection and obtain a report containing projected changes in bankful width, bankful flow, and 100-year peak discharge. In the project's current phase, DFW and the Climate Impact Group are collaborating to update the projections and to develop better ways of conveying information to the users. It's a really impressive project, and I just want to say congratulations to Morgan and her team, Timothy Quinn and others. And maybe, Morgan, you want to just say one or two words about that too.
Yeah, this, and Jeff could as well. This is a multi-year project. And so he also had a hand at former Habitat program director in helping that team be successful and supporting their work. But essentially we have some of the best and brightest in the Habitat Science Division, Tim Quinn, Jane Atha, Lynn Helbrecht, who now works in Jeff's team, noting that some of our fundamental assumptions about how precipitation is going to turn into stream flow, and therefore, like, man, if we don't know that accurately, and that's going to be changing, our goals around making sure that when infrastructure crosses water systems, that it's big enough to really let that stream do what it needs to do, we really needed to look at that. And they really, as it said in the short blurb, pioneered this work. And as a result, that work has come to underpin changes that we're looking at making in our regulations to require some kind of upsizing in water crossings when we know the stream's going to get bigger. And it's really helping restoration projects and others make choices about how to put infrastructure that protects resources, and then we have certainty it's going to continue protecting resources in the future. So really pivotal.
You know, this would be so important. I mean, OFWA is fine and the award's great, but that's got to get out into the civil engineering world. I mean, we got to make sure that the people that are doing this are aware of this, you know, product. So I think that's part of the outreach that we should look at. So.
Couldn't agree more, Commissioner Smith, and the team and the program, I think, have made a lot of headway as well. Washington State Department of Transportation, even though we do not yet reflect the need to do this in regulations, they've actually been collaborating with us for the last several years using this information actively on the ground. And I think one of the reasons I'm expecting the regulatory push to be a little easier than it could be to make an update like this to regulation is that we've been working on more like a voluntary basis with Public Works, Department of Transportation, and other project proponents for a while. And I think it's really compelling. One of the things that I know we've heard from some of the various engineering groups and Public Works folks is like, hey man, yes, this is mathematically driven. We get it. We don't want to use public put in infrastructure good. That we have reason to believe is going to wash out, you know, 10 years down the road.
That's good. Thank you.
Yeah, so I'd like to thank Amy for bringing that to our attention, and congratulations. It's a prestigious award, and hopefully you've passed that on to the governor's office, and so that they are aware of of the work and the recognition.
Good point. I have not, but I will make a note.
Yeah, good point. And Jeff, your little paws raised there?
Yeah, thanks. Mr. Chair, I just want to say this is outstanding work, and it's serving as the foundation of a lot of additional work that we're doing. For example, having conversations about predicted climate conditions as local governments permit land use actions. Right, so that we're actually achieving no net loss through time, and not just seeing no impacts today, but significant impacts down the road as climate starts to express itself even more. And I think this is critical, and it's connected to the co-manager habitat work plan. You know, our systems are changing, and if we as an agency aren't looking far enough ahead, then we're going to create bigger problems for the people that sit in our seats when we leave them. So we want to make sure that all generations have an opportunity in the future to fish for salmon and steelhead. And that means we need to be thinking about the actions that we take today and what needs to be done in order to stabilize some of these systems as instability increases in these watersheds and in our food webs.
No, absolutely. And you know, Amy, to follow up on Commissioner Keogh's comment, I think getting that to the governor is a very, very important thing. And I would encourage to find the appropriate, find somebody in the engineering world, public works world, that could add a statement of support to that, whatever you send out. So the governor can see that what we're doing is crossing disciplines, being recognized by other, you know, non-traditional kind of partners, but getting an endorsement about how important this is by the Planning and Water Works Association or something like that would add a little credibility to something just coming from DFW. Okay. Anything else for the good of the order? Well, hearing nothing, thank you all, and go have lunch, and we will see most of you tomorrow morning, bright and early. Bye-bye.
Yes, very good. Thank you.
Thank you all.